Welcome to the Gifters Podcast. I'm your host, Christopher Kai. This podcast is sponsored by the GPS Online Program, which teaches you how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business. For more information, go to ChristopherKai.com. Our guest today is Artin Nazarian. He is a media executive, author of a book called Side Adventure, startup advisor, as well as career coach. Artin, welcome to our show today.
Thank you for having me. This is amazing.
First of all, I'm not going to dive into your book yet, but just so you know, audience, it's going to be exciting and fun. I actually saw a sneak preview of the cover, so I'm like super excited to talk about that. But I always love the backstory, the origin story. Were there any childhood memories, Artin, that you can share with us that really had a really strong impact on your life?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. Yeah. You know, I was born in Iran as a Christian Armenian. And when the regime changed over there, kind of the fundamental Islamic regime, shortly after that is when the Iraq-Iran war happened. And, you know, there was bombs falling on civilians. It wasn't a very civilized war. It was a very primitive war. And I remember being around 5 years old, seeing bombs drop around me. And as a kid, walking through that area and seeing stretchers with a body in there, which was an image that I can't get out of my head even to this day, because it was such a shocking image. And that is a very strong childhood memory that has stayed with me ever since. Not a good one, but it's a strong one.
Yeah, and I'm literally getting chills, because how does that affect you? How do you even process that? Because didn't you tell me you saw like a stretcher and you saw a leg falling off the stretcher? It just, how do you even process that? How do you even know that it even happened? Do you actually remember it like as you're growing up, or did you have like a flashback at one point when you're a teenager or an adult about that experience?
Yeah, the way I recall it is I remember seeing that stretcher and the leg and really not being able to resonate or comprehend, what did I just see? But as the war continued, I saw that image a lot more, especially on TV. And that's where I realized what was happening. You know, one of the things that was happening all around the city, there were X's on every window, and the X's were tapes, because the tapes were supposed to prevent the shatter of the glass to fly into the house. So there was a lot of people that had glass damage on their bodies too. So you could see on TV, not only a dead, but all the shattered glass that had damaged their body. It's an image you can never get out of your head. I don't wish upon anybody to see anything like that. But I soon realized what I had seen when I was five.
You know, Artin, it reminds me, I'm writing a new book called Story-Based Leadership, How Innovators Like Steve Jobs Build Global Brands Through Storytelling. And one of the people I'm profiling is a guy named Jorge Perez. He's one of the most successful real estate developers in the world. He's a billionaire. But he talked about, again, like you, a childhood memory where he had a father who was an executive. He was based in Cuba. After Cuba nationalized, they lost everything. And he distinctly remembers as a young boy at the airport in Havana, and his mother had to give away her jewelry, and they were exiled into Colombia. But what I'm saying, just like you, whether it's a billionaire who real estate is developing real estate, in your case, those very memories as a kid really conveys a deep, perhaps understanding that you don't even know about. Now, from there, how did you get out of that situation?
So as things are getting really bad in Iran, for Christians there with the war, my parents decided we need to get out and get my sister and myself out of the country. So when I was about 10, we left the country as refugees. And as we were actually flying out of Iran, the airplane was hit with an anti-aircraft missile. So we flew to Madrid with one engine without knowing. My dad knew because he had friends in the airport. So he knew what was going on, but kept it from my mom because she would have freaked out. So we ended up in Madrid with one engine as refugees. And that's where we spent about a year before we were given the green card and clearance to head over to the US.
Well, Artin, just to be clear, just your mother, not just your mother would have freaked out. Anyone would have freaked out.
I know. I'm glad I had no idea what was going on either. I was just a naive 10-year-old.
And why Madrid?
That was just at the time, that was one of the countries that was accepting refugees. You know, I was an Armenian kid that spoke Armenian and Farsi, landed in a country speaking Spanish that I'd never spoken. It was a challenging time at first, but I soon realized how to make friends without the language, and I started drawing for the kids. And soon that became kind of a small side business for me and kind of my first entrepreneurship, where I would take orders from other kids. And it was a lot of animated characters, but sometimes people would ask me some complex things. Like one kid asked me to draw Arnold Schwarzenegger posing in his Mr. Universe pose. That's what I did to kind of make friends. Eventually, I kind of picked up the language. Being 10, 11, you pick up languages very quickly. And I was almost fluent by the time we left Madrid and came to the U.S. But it was a fantastic experience. I still love the country. And anytime the World Cup comes around, Spain is the team that I cheer for.
Yeah, that's amazing, Artin. And it's fascinating because culture and where we're from really does a lot of things to us as a person. I remember when I went to Jerusalem, it was for a State Department program where they invite executives to teach some of the entrepreneurs in an area. And I remember going to the Old City. For those of you who might not know, the Old City, you have four quarters there. And three of the most popular religions or most well-known religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, are all there. But when you mentioned that you're Armenian, I don't know if you even know this, but there is a Christian quarter, an Islam quarter, a Jewish quarter, and an Armenian quarter.
And yep.
Every time I meet Armenians, and as I think I mentioned to you, I've lived in Glendale, California, with a lot of Armenians, but I'm always so impressed with the culture because of the fact they're just so proud, driven, cultured people. But I didn't know there's an actual quarter there in the Old City in Jerusalem. So I'm curious, what do you feel as an Armenian person that allows you, like, what are you proud about that? Because you're literally an example, not just for all Americans or all people, but also for your own race and for your own ethnicity.
Yeah, you know, it's a very timely question because we just had a 6-week war, Armenian Azerbaijan. Wow. And there was a piece of land that this war is all about. Now 150,000 Armenians are being displaced and moved out of that area. But throughout the thousands of history that Armenians have been a culture, it is such a strong culture that keeps everybody together. Half of Armenians actually live outside of the country. So the diaspora and the culture keeps it all together. And during the war, the outpouring and how the community came together to raise money for the soldiers and everybody and the families over there was unbelievable. It made me so proud to be Armenian because of that culture. It's, you know, family, history, embracing that Armenians were the first kind of to accept Christianity. I'm very proud. And over the last 6 weeks, my level of pride even went up higher seeing how everybody came together.
Fascinating. Like I said, culturally, you go from Iran, from an Armenian background, to Madrid, which is Spanish, obviously. So based on those cultural experiences, how do you feel that affected you when you did come to the States? So talk to us about that transition from coming from Iran to Spain to the U.S. How old were you when you came to the U.S. and how was that transition?
When we got to the U.S., I had just turned 11. Wow. And I started fifth grade elementary school. And it was in Glendale, California. So luckily, I was surrounded by other Armenians who were during the same type of transition as we were, refugees coming from either Spain or Germany or Austria. That was kind of the common road at the time in the late 80s. So culturally, actually, I felt more at home when we got here because I was surrounded with more Armenians. In Spain, I think because I was still trying to make sense of a new country, it didn't dawn on me to think about it being 10 years old. But over here, it started to hit home about, wow, you know, a community of Armenians in Glendale, how home I felt. As I kind of started to grow up in Glendale, making friends that are Armenian that I'm still very close with, transitioned to high school and being surrounded by the film industry, that's kind of what I decided to do. I'm like, wow, the glitz and glamour, this is amazing. I want to be on that Oscar, accepting an Oscar. How cool would that be? And my parents were so supportive. So that's kind of what I went after. I wanted to be a filmmaker and enter film school right after high school.
Wow. And where'd you go to film school?
I went to Cal State Northridge.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
And
Oh, go ahead.
And wanting to go in film school, you know, it was all about the glitz and glamour. But once I started making the little short films and film school, I realized that I'm actually really passionate about producing and building things that could have a lasting memory. It kind of took me back to my 10-year-old self in Madrid of creating art. I'm like, you know, it's that creation that I really enjoy. And, when trying to raise money to make my thesis project, it's a very funny story how my project got selected and the school funded half of my budget, which was about $10,000. Wow. The other half, I didn't know what to do.
You went partying?
And that, I took the money and went partying. I didn't know how to raise the other money, the other half of the money, but that's where my kind of entrepreneurship brain kicked in again. And I ended up creating a film festival for the students, leveraging my internship contacts I had at Sony to be judges. So once I remember launching the film festival posters all around campus and students coming to me and saying, are you going to enter the film festival? Not realizing that I was behind it. I kept hush hush. I didn't want people to know I was behind it. And shortly after, I had checks arriving at my parents' house and they're asking me, what are these checks? Why are people sending me checks? They thought I was up to some illegal activity. I'm like, no, it's very legal. Trust me. But long story short, I ended up raising the rest of the money that I needed, bought the film stock, and was able to produce my thesis project, which was, I thought it was amazing at the time, but looking back, not that good. But it did get me into the Academy screenings of regional kind of film projects, student film projects. And that's another aha moment that I had when my film went on screen and it said, directed and produced by Artem Nazarian. I looked to my left and that's where my parents were sitting. And the smile that they had on their face, and I knew they were proud of me. That's when I realized that, yeah, I am all about creating something that has a lasting memory. But the reason why I did it was because I wanted my parents proud. I wanted to make sure the sacrifices that they made, leaving war-torn Iran, refugees with no money in Spain, dragging everything to the US, that was not all for nothing, that there was something that they did it for a good reason. So I realized that what I'm driven by and what everybody is driven by is an emotion. And I realized that emotion that I am driven by is to make sure that my parents are proud of me.
That's a great story, Artin. Let's talk about that smile you put on their face, because it's a perfect segue, because I was looking at your profile and your expertise. You have worked at Disney, one of the most well-known companies in the world, that their very job is to put smile on people's faces. So as I looked at your profile and your experience, you've been there for 17 plus years, almost 20 years. So you have both this entrepreneurship understanding and entrepreneurship. So tell us about that journey in Disney as an executive.
Yeah, so I did, like you said, I started a little over 17 years ago as on the ground level, entry level position. And it's not what I had signed up for, because coming out of film school, I thought I want to be this well-known film director or producer. But life took different turns and I started at Disney. And back then it was VHS and DVD was just a brand new thing. So we're talking a long time ago. Slowly made my way through the ranks, but I never lost my sense of creation. So entrepreneurship was always there with me. I leveraged that mindset of mine to help me grow internally to become an executive with a lot of projects and innovations that I created. But on the side, I continued pursuing my own startup ideas. It started with filmmaking, and we wrote with a partner a few scripts that almost got sold. But as you know, almost is never good enough. And then I soon realized that film is such a risky investment that it's really hard to raise money for. But this was post-dot-com bubble bust, and there was a lot of money pouring into technology. I was involved with some innovative technology solutions in Disney, so I had gotten a sense of what does it mean to develop technology. Said, you know what, I'm going to give this a try. Well, it was a lot of failures at first, because I was just figuring out what does it mean to even do a tech startup? Well, one failure after another, eventually I got my big break where I was able to raise about $4 million. And we built a platform for hospitality and nightlife. And that was really my second job. For about 4 or 5 years, I had a corporate job, nights and weekends, I had a startup. And I was probably putting in about 100, 120 hours of work every week, keeping both afloat, because I wanted to make sure that I was excelling at Disney, but also setting up the startup for success, however that success went.
So you're talking about like Elon style.
Yeah. I was single, I was driven, I was ambitious. And once this hospitality startup got acquired by another startup, I was itching for another one, because, you know, corporate world, there's always ups and downs. Things might be working, things might not be working out. So I went down the path of let's do another startup. I soon then realized my wife is pregnant. Wow. So I thought to myself, what do I want? You know, when I think about I'm 95 years old on my deathbed and I look back, what am I going to be most proud of? I know I wanted to make my parents proud, but what am I going to be most proud of? And I soon realized to be the best dad I can be and to be the best husband I could be is what I'm going to be most proud of. I'm probably not going to think about the app that I built in Disney or the startup that I did. That's what. So I said, let me put that startup aside and focus on what is it going to be to be a dad. I started reading so many books. I was reading books about being dad. I read books for moms, just so I can learn their perspective as well. But that entrepreneurship in me, that mindset didn't go away. So I had so many people asking me, how do you do two major jobs at the same time? How'd you build an app? How'd you raise money? So I decided, I've always wanted to write a book. This is what I'm going to write about. I'm going to write about what does it take to excel in the corporate world and leverage that learning and that experience to pursue your own ideas. And that's where the idea of the book was born. And it was a 3-year journey to write it.
It's amazing. I mean, some people think, oh, I have to be like Mark Zuckerberg and quit my job and move out to the Bay Area to create a company. But some people are like Warby Parker that have their day job still and then go off on some of the side hustle, because there's not a one size fits all. But the most important thing is just doing it. In your case, let's first talk about how do you succeed at a company, because you're doing that now at one of the biggest companies in the world, but also this side hustle or this main hustle from your book. So first of all, what advice might you give for people that are watching that really want to rise up the ranks like you have in a company that at this scale?
You first have to establish the right foundation. You know, most people, when they start a job, they think that's it, they're in. Actually, that's when the hard work starts. You have to establish a foundation by showing up, over-delivering, networking. And while you're networking, actually aligning yourself with the leadership that is in place, but also identifying who are the future leadership so you can align with them, because at the end of the day, they will drag you up with them. And you have to pick one problem a year and solve. So what I did was I talked to all my networks and leaderships and, you know, management. What is one problem that's bothering you this year? And I would kind of figure out a list of problems and then tackle one that I would solve that would shine a spotlight on me. And that strategy has still worked to this day, where I find one problem that's worthy enough to solve, and I go after and solve it. Most of the time, I have no idea how to solve it in the beginning. I just know this seems to be a problem that if I solve, it's going to get me noticed. And then I go figure out how to do it.
Yeah. Great advice. I want to actually stress that and highlight that, because when I used to work for American Express, again, similar massive company like Disney, I was on Wall Street. This is 20 plus years ago, but I distinctly remember there's various levels, meaning you have analysts and then senior analyst and then assistant manager and then manager, assistant director, director, VP, SVP, EVP, president. What I'm saying is it's a very big bureaucracy. And a lot of people, if they're only focusing on their network of colleagues or friends that are in the same, there literally is a pay level. So if I was an analyst that I started, I didn't get to manager and skip two levels because I was hanging out with everyone that was part of the same pay grade. It sounds pretty harsh, but in your case, that advice is so premium, so that those who are listening and watching know that networking, we all know, is important, but based on network science by a guy named Dr. Ron Burt, he studied it. And it came down to two types of networks. There's a closed network, which is everyone that you have on your phone, looks like you, acts like you, prays like you, eats like you. And you have an open network, which is exactly what you're saying. So I don't even know if you knew that, Artin, but it's based on science, where you have to go outside of your comfort level, especially if they're senior, more senior than you, which ideally, not just your boss, but your boss's boss, or your boss's boss's boss, because that's how you get this macro vision, which you did perfectly. And then the other part is, even if you met them, if you can't provide value and solutions, you're done. So I wanted to just really highlight those two very specific things, whether as an entrepreneur, which you're doing well, Artin, or as an entrepreneur, it's about leveling up your networks and also being a problem solver, not, oh my gosh, life is hard. Oh my gosh, this isn't easy. Well, it's not supposed to be. So I wanted to really highlight those really two core skill sets. Now, we talked about the entrepreneur. Let's talk more about your book and really dive deeper into that. First of all, I love the title, Side Adventure. Tell us why you chose that title.
Because, you know, you hear about side hustles or side gigs. I didn't really like that terminology because it implies something small. A venture is something that's big. And that's what I went after. You know, raising $4 million is not a gig.
Yeah.
It's a venture. And, but it was an adventure. And it was an adventure of a lifetime that I took so many lessons out. And that's how the book title was seeded, that it's a side venture, but it's also an adventure, because you will step out of your comfort zone. You will put on hats that you never thought you would put on, and you will meet people that you never thought you'd meet. We had a launch party with Kanye West being our performer.
Who is that? I don't know about that. I'm just kidding.
You know, I never thought that stuff like that would happen. And as part of that, you know, you also end up identifying what are areas that you might like, because in your corporate job, you might be in marketing, but your itch for doing something else, pursuing your own idea on the side, even if you decide that entrepreneurship is not for you because it's too much work, you still get the benefit of the byproduct of figuring out, you know what, I really like sales, or I really like the technology and product aspect of it. No matter what, it's a win-win situation, whether that startup fails or not, because you identify what fulfills you and what makes you happy. And that's the core message of the book, that when you pursue that side adventure, you will find fulfillment and happiness, because you will very quickly find your path to what you like to do and focus on that, rather than being lost in the corporate shuffle of a job that you started and don't know how to get out of.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, frankly, again, a lot of time, just to remind our listeners and our guests that you don't always have to dive in and say, I'm going to only do this, because the vast majority of businesses fail. I've had multiple businesses. I'm 20 years in. And a lot of people, frankly, they don't have the hustle sometimes, or even that adventure. But I love the fact that you literally have what most people would be desirable of, Artin, which is, in business, if you run out of cash, you have no business. So in your case, you have both your day job, which at least you have a consistent cash flow, but you also can do things that you want with that cash flow to create other companies. And in your case, you literally raise money. So a lot of people ask me, how do you raise money, especially $4 million? What are some of the suggestions you might have for our guests?
Well, one suggestion is, especially if you're a first-time entrepreneur, an aspiring entrepreneur without a track record, you're not going to raise a dollar with a PowerPoint presentation. You better have done your due diligence and at least built a prototype and validated that prototype actually, when it becomes a functioning product, solves the problem that the market will pay for. And that's kind of what was my approach. And it didn't happen overnight. I had multiple failures. And through those failures is when I realized how to go about the process of raising money. So it was an interesting way that it happened, because when I built that prototype, the iPhone was just out, but there was no app store. But I soon realized that mobile is the future. So before the app store actually even released, I started kind of researching, how do we build mobile apps? And I soon realized that it's such a new thing, and it's such a premium product still, that it's gonna take a lot of money to do. So I put all my focus on raising money. And when I kind of told the universe, I'm gonna raise money, all of a sudden, a bunch of people started coming into my network and putting fillers out there, what I wanna do. I met a person that was really interested in what I was trying to do and the problem I was trying to solve shortly after the iPhone App Store launched. And we knew we were on the right direction. And this person ended up being the catalyst to introducing us to other investors that came in as a pool and helped us raise the $4 million seed money to get the company going. So going back to your question, just being kind of laser focused on what you want to do, and making sure that you are solving the problem that people will be willing to pay for. And if you do those two, funny thing happens in the universe where the doors open up. But if you don't do those two things, people are kind of wishy-washy. They don't know if you can actually execute. They might think you're just the idea guy without execution.
Yeah, that's a great point, Artin. One of the things that was most telling in this interview, Artin, is the fact that you talked about how when you're 95 years old, or when I'm 95 years old, looking back at my lifetime, and I would look at my childhood, and there were so many times I didn't feel like I was good enough. I didn't read really fast. I didn't memorize really fast. I wasn't really smart, at least what I thought. And I know you wrote this book. So you have this vision of where you saw yourself even as a 10-year-old. And now you're talking about your startups and your book. What do you feel your vision is for your book, in terms of, given the fact that I didn't feel like I was good enough, are there any specific stories that you might want to share that really to inspire our audience that they can, like you, be a success?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I always felt like I had a chip on my shoulder as well, not feeling like I was good enough compared to the kids that went to the Ivy schools and Stanford and Harvard and, you know, the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world. I always felt like I was never good enough. And even going to film school, I felt like, well, I might not be good enough to become that director. And I ended up not being a film director. So all of that really weighed on me, saying, I might not be good enough, but I can't let my parents down. They've sacrificed so much. And the book really is about who I was 20, 25 years ago, that chip on their shoulder, wanting to do bigger things in life, but don't know how, and don't have the money, don't come from a wealthy family, don't have the connections to the Ivy League schools, don't have the connections to people that would guide them the right way. I really want to go back and help myself 25 years ago to do things the right way faster, instead of all the trial and error that I did to get to where I am. That is a driving force. That chip on my shoulder was a driving force to accomplish what I did, but then to give back and help others that were in the position that I was 25 years ago.
Artin, your story really is an inspiring one, because frankly, in life, it's not fair sometimes. And when you look at the people that are most successful, they don't always get into some schools that they want to. For instance, Steven Spielberg, everyone knows him as the most famous director in the world. He tried to get into USC, which is like the Harvard of film schools, and they rejected him. But he went to Cal State, which is the same school that you went to. So I want to encourage our listeners and our viewers just to know that just because your initial plan doesn't work out, if you look at Artin's story, his persistence, his vision, his network, and his book, for sure, definitely reach out and learn about his book, you will be a success. Artin, thank you so much for being on our show today. Your story is so inspiring, and I personally look forward to reading your book.
Thank you so much for having me.
Martin. Thank you for listening to the Gifters Podcast. If you want to learn how to turn your story into a successful speaking and online coaching business, go to christopherkai.com to learn more.